We're going to head to the stage with Sean Lennon, the son of John and Yoko and his band. Sean has recently released his second album called Friendly Fire, which actually is accompanied by a sumptuous film for each track. And I asked Sean if that was the initial concept from the very beginning.
No, it wasn't at all. But when I was mixing the record, I had an opportunity to make a film for Parachute, the song on the record, and during making that, we managed to pull it off for $15,000 on 35mm, and we filmed the whole thing in a day, and I realized that, considering the video budget, I thought maybe we could do 9 more, which is all we needed to do once we had that one. So that was how I got the idea, and, you know, within a week, I had written the treatments for the other 9.
Wait a second. $15,000 was all... I mean,
well, yeah, because we made everyone work for free.
Oh.
Well, I mean, you know, we paid the union people, but, you know, all my friends worked on it, you know, just as a favor.
We
filmed the whole thing in 12 days so that it was very condensed. We didn't have a prolonged shoot session. Shooting whatever they call it. I don't know the lingo, but it's not a session. That's a music session. A film shoot.
A shoot.
We didn't have a prolonged shoot, but that was how we did it, you know, cheaply.
I say that with a surprise in my voice because it is so absolutely gorgeously production design.
I know. Well, that just goes to show you how much people waste money when they're making those stupid videos with wind blowing in their hair and slow motion glass breaking and stuff like that. That they've spent all the money on trailers and stuff that doesn't matter, you know?
Now, I would expect that your mom would probably have more to say about... if she were to comment on what you're doing, would she have more to say about film, more to say about the music, or is it all the same to her?
Yeah, for her, art is secondary to concept. That's why she's called a conceptual artist. She believes that the art takes place in your mind, and then whatever medium or whichever media you manifest it in is sort of circumstantial or secondary. It depends on how you feel, but that the medium isn't the message. The message is the message. I mean, so yeah, she tends to work in a lot of different media, and... she kind of influenced me to do the same, I would say.
Now, what did she think? Because what you've done, the film, people haven't had a chance to see it. They should definitely, instead of downloading, buy the album.
Please,
get a chance to see all those.
Please.
But it for her, it's probably a pretty conventional film. Did she?
Yes, actually, it's funny that you say that. That's clever. When I was making the film, she did kind of at one moment say, "Why are you doing such a mainstream kind of idea or such a sort of you know, commercial type thing?" And I don't think she understood that I was kind of doing it with a sense of irony. Obviously, I was making nods to Stanley Kubrick and Woody Allen and all these sort of super mega famous directors, and I was doing it with a sense of humor and at the same time trying to construct a kind of surrealist narrative. In the end, she really loved it. So, but it is, you're the first person to think of that, because at first she was like, you know, the way I make films is just, you know, I'll film like a fly buzzing around an ashtray with some, you know, screaming in the background. And that's, you know, she does really well with that. She's into Dada. She's into the Dadaist. She's into the surrealist.
Yeah.
But I think once she saw the way I put it together, I think she appreciated my kind of more modern take on everything.
To really understand Friendly Fire, I think you have to understand the backstory of where it all came from for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a breakup album.
It sure is. Yeah, it was a breakup album, and you know, I just felt that when I was writing those songs, they really felt like an appropriate kind of next chapter to my music career, because the first record was not a breakup album. It was really about a relationship that was working out beautifully, and also about a period of my life that was very kind of you know, optimistic and kind of, you know, it was like the dawn of my sort of, you know, 20s. And now it's like in my 30s, I feel like I've grown up more, I've learned more, I've experienced more. So this is kind of like a more, you know, a more experienced version of myself singing about love again.
You also got more musical experience in between too.
I mean,
musical experience outside of the spotlight, if you can ever live your life outside of the spotlight. But, you know, playing bass with Chico Bono is certainly not being the front man.
No.
Was that valuable?
It was invaluable. I mean, it was... It was music school to me. I mean, we toured the world like 5 times. I mean, it was just really in the van touring. You were playing 7 shows a night, you know. And that was just chops central. It just sort of made my playing so much better and my singing. I mean, Yuka actually had me singing and playing completely different things at the same time. It helped with my multitasking. But not just Chibamata, touring on my own with my solo career and touring with my mother. I mean, I've been touring my whole life, basically. I mean, not my whole life, but since I was 17, I pretty much have been touring, you know, playing gigs. And I think that's a very important part of developing your sort of moving from being just someone who writes songs in their bedroom to actually who's someone who's a professional musician. It's been kind of you know, my equivalent of going to class, because I never took a music class. So
When we actually, you had such a glut of talking with people when your first album came out, but it was, I think we talked kind of towards the end of it, and I think you were getting frustrated with the way the attention was being focused on who you are as opposed to what you do. And you made a statement at the time. You said this. You said, "I don't think anybody who's into the Beatles can understand my music."
Well, and I was probably being reactionary.
Right.
I mean, that's clearly not true. But that's the thing. I was younger, and I was really I had a more sort of – I had thinner skin, and I had a more naive outlook or optimistic outlook on the process of releasing a record. And when I actually had to go through the process of promotion, it really turned me off and just stressed me out and kind of depressed me, actually, you know. I just felt like I had no chance, you know. Even though music is the thing that I was born to do, I feel it, you know. I'm good at music, and that's what is in me. I felt almost like I could never do it, you know. It really depressed me, because all I encountered was people focusing on things that weren't me, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Things that were ulterior or sort of irrelevant. But at the same time, I mean, so I was being reactionary because I got a lot of this sort of Beatles flack, you know. But it's definitely not true. I mean, I'm a Beatles fan, so I mean, if Beatles fans can't like my music, then I can't. You know what I mean? Which right. is ridiculous.
Well, you're a Beach Boys fan. I hear
sure.
I hear gorgeous harmonies of that. You obviously you're a T-Rex fan because you do one of Mark Boland's.
I'm a fan
tunes.
Of, you know, pretty much everything that's in that top echelon of music history, from
right.
Beethoven to Brahms to Beatles to Beastie Boys. I like it all. You know.
Excellent. Well, Yuka Honda's here playing keyboards. Who else is in the band today?
Oh, we've got Cameron. The problem is I don't know their last names yet, because I just met them a few days ago. It's Billy, Cameron, and Brad.
Excellent.
They all played with Martha Wainwright and with Rufus Wainwright. When both Martha and Rufus are good friends of mine, so they kind of hooked us up with their band, I guess.
And we'll head to the stage and we'll start with Dead Meat. How does this work as an introduction to this album?
Well, you know, it's kind of the essence of the aesthetic of what I was going for, which is this idea of really well-constructed, kind of beautiful, I mean, not to compliment myself, but, you know, trying to make well-constructed chords that are very beautiful and lush and kind of sophisticated, but with a lyric that might kind of juxtapose against that beauty with a little bit more of a intensity, maybe an anger. I was experimenting with sort of creating a darker, spookier mood that it represented what it felt like to be confused and have a relationship falling apart around you, and participating in that destruction and also being a victim of it at the same time.
And hence Dead Meat.
Yeah.
We'll go to the stage now at World Cafe Live. Sean, congratulations on this work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's a beautiful venue, and it's nice to be here. And this is actually this band's first show ever. Yes. And we sound pretty good, if I don't say so myself. This song is called Wait For Me, which is Attends-moi in French, for those of you from Canada. And it goes something like this, with an intro, by the way. Thank you. So this is a song called Friendly. It's a title track off of my album, which is called Friendly Fire. And I say album because Elvis said that once on a show, and I always thought that was funny. And my new album. My album, yes. And some more stuff as well. So, is that a word I can say on the radio? Stuff? Okay. All right, this is a Friendly Fire, and it goes a little something like this. This one is called Parachute, right? Yes, Parachute. I don't hear it, though. Oh, there we go. Aha.
Parachute, Sean Lennon and his great band on stage at World Cafe Live. And thanks a lot to Sean for playing the tunes from Friendly Fire for us live. That album is available at our World Cafe CD store at worldcafe.npr.org if you're looking for it.